Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Fighting for the Ground podcast, where I discover stories of grit, resilience, and connection. I'm your host, Marie Gettle-Gilmartin, and this podcast is brought to you by Fertile Ground Communications. Do you struggle to put words to the screen? Is writing the very last thing you want to do in your day? My mission is to make communications painless for my clients. I can turn a piece of lackluster, jargon-filled, or technical prose into clear, dynamic narrative. I help my clients discover how to tell their stories or solve their communications challenges. Look us up on fertilegroundcommunications.com. I alternate this Fighting Fertile Ground podcast with my other podcast, Companies That Care, which is about business leaders making a difference in the world. On both of my podcasts, I strive to highlight historically excluded voices, the people who don't always get a platform. Check out my website for more details. This week, I interview Malena Ray Johnson, who uprooted her family to Canada to find better opportunities for her as a Black woman. Malena is a speaker, comedian, author, and communication expert for introverts. She discovered other Black American women were living their best lives outside of the United States. So she and her husband began looking for the best place to relocate, and then the 2016 election happened. Their move plans accelerated dramatically. She has a fascinating story to tell about doing what so many of us talked about doing after the 2016 election. Are things better in Canada? Let's find out. Hello, Malena. Welcome to the Fighting Fertile Ground podcast.
Hello, Marie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation. Malena and I met through a business coaching program that we're on, and we were paired in a role play. So we've talked about life, we've talked about our families. So let's talk about your life. I always like to start at the beginning. So can you share with our listeners about your childhood?
I was born in Arkansas because that's where my mother was when she had me. She is now a retired professor. She has spent most of her life teaching nursing at various universities, mostly HBCUs. When I was four, my mother and I moved to St. Thomas, which is where her family is from and where she grew up, because my father died while we were in Arkansas. And we moved to St. Thomas, and we lived with my grandmother and grandfather initially, and spent the rest of my childhood there from 4 to 17. So I stayed there from kindergarten to 12th grade. I graduated and went to film school at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles.
So what was St. Thomas like growing up in St. Thomas?
It was a place that I appreciated more after I left. It's a cosmopolitan place. So similar to Puerto Rico, there's an international airport there. So there's a lot of different cultures in the Caribbean. It was both living in one of the few places in the Caribbean that is a U.S. territory, but also being in a larger Caribbean culture. There's a lot of different people of various accents, various peoples from different places. And there was definitely stuff that I didn't like the persistent homophobia and there's only so many people. there's about 100,000 people, I think. I'd have to check, but I thought it was 100,000 people in the territory, and half of them live on St. Thomas. So there's only so many people, and everybody knows everything that's going on with everybody all the time. And there's only so much stuff to do, even though it's a tourist destination. So there's a lot of stuff to do in general, but there is definitely a part of me that wanted to go and do other things in other places and really wanted to live in Los Angeles and become a filmmaker. There was a desire for me to go off and live a bigger life, which I eventually did. But then going to Los Angeles and dealing with the weird segregation that's present everywhere, and people not leaving their neighborhoods to go to another neighborhood. It's like you would just live in the area that you were in, and you could spend your whole life driving to West Hollywood or to Disney World or places in Los Angeles, but not really interacting with other people. There are people that I met there that said that they didn't interact with any Hispanic people. And I was like, I don't understand how that's possible. And we're living in Los Angeles. So that was a weird thing for me because in St. Thomas, how I grew up, specifically my socioeconomic bracket, I interacted with various people all the time. And it's kind of hard to do if you want to eat.
So it was pretty a very diverse environment. And then you went into the segregated environment. And backing up a little bit about the homophobia, is it a pretty conservative population then?
The grand scheme of things, of the different peoples on this island all coming together. Like the thing that is still persistent, as in every other community in the United States, is that you might have lots of different people living in the same area, having their various racial issues and ethnic issues and national issues, because lots of people come from different islands, but there is still the shared trait of homophobia that is still there. It's just something that I wish wasn't there, because there are so many other great traits that St. Thomas has. I mean, there's lots of things to work on. That's one of them.
Well, you know, I just looked it up, and it actually says that before 2001, anal sex and oral sex were criminal offenses. So that may be part of it. It's been fairly recent that they actually decriminalized that. It actually says also that it's a conservative religious society. This is the Virgin Islands in general. Mm-hmm. And so when there have been actually attacks on same-sex couples, people have justified them by saying that they were following the Bible.
I'm sure that all of those things happen in Texas or happen in Vermont.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But,
oh, totally.
But there's more people there and more stories going on.
Right. Right. I understand. Tell us about your family. You mentioned that you are thinking about adopting, but tell us about the ages of your kids and how did you meet your husband and all that?
I met my husband on OkCupid. At this point, it was right after I had graduated from business school. So I went to business school at the University of Southern California, and I focused on marketing and entertainment. We have been together for over a decade now. We are adoptive parents, and I had a biological child, and we would like to adopt more children now that we are here in Canada. There are a lot of children who are in difficult situations, who need homes, and it can be hard to find them. And there's a lot of myths about adoption out there. So dispelling those myths is a process as well. But there are definitely more children, especially older children, who need homes and safe environments. So we are trying to provide that for the children that we can.
That's great. So tell us your grit and resilience story.
I will tell you my most recent grit and resilience story, which is about choosing to move from Los Angeles to Toronto. So we actually made the move in 2018, but we had been working on this since 2015, when I was feeling frustrated with my career. And I felt at this point I had left NBC Universal, where I'd been working in marketing and marketing strategy. I had been at that point tutoring people, also admissions counseling, doing that freelance. So I help people with their test prep and with their admissions packages for college, university, and graduate school. I felt like having done that, I had more knowledge to impart to other people who wanted to do the same thing. And I couldn't really figure out a way to use my knowledge and experience and extensive education by that point to the best of my abilities. And I was reading about other Black women who were from the United States who had moved to other places in the world and found more success there and found more freedom there outside of the scope of racism and sexism that they were experiencing in the United States. So I told my spouse that I wanted to investigate other places for us to live, and told them to investigate Bermuda and the Bahamas, since I'd already come from the Caribbean, and then found that they were really looking for straight men. And I was like, okay, then. So we looked at Hawaii. It has the largest percentage of multiracial population, but it also had a higher cost of living with lower employment opportunities than Los Angeles. So then we looked at Canada, as we had heard about the healthcare system and the educational system. And so we decided Canada would be a good place to look. The population of Canada is smaller than the population of California. There's approximately 37 million people in Canada and 40 million people in California. So I wanted to know where all the Black people lived, and they do not identify as the same way as in the United States. So it's much harder to identify people. Not like they don't say that they're Black, but there's more of a affiliation with their country of origin or their ancestral country of origin, like from the Caribbean or from African nations. I was looking at places that had a large population, and we looked at Vancouver, Montreal, and Toronto. And at the time, I had my hair braided and was looking at braiding salons, and I found that Montreal had a few braiding salons and Toronto had many. So I figured there was a population to support that. So I picked Toronto. So that was done. So we picked Toronto, and that was probably early in 2016. And we're like, all right, we'll do that someday. And then the 2016 election happened. And then the day after, I told my spouse that I wanted to move on our plan to move now. And he said, okay. So we directed all of our attention to that. And it felt like it took forever. And we got rejected for permanent residency multiple times. And then I decided I was going to apply to graduate school so that we could go. And the first place said no. And then the second place I applied said yes. So once I got my acceptance, I said, we can go forward. And so that was in May of 2018. And so we had already been preparing, but we got rid of almost all of our stuff, tried to pack as little as possible to be moved. All of the whole process felt like it took way longer than it did, because we're just going and going and going. Now we're permanent residents, and we plan to take the citizenship test next year.
Congratulations. So you are one of those people when, you know, so many of us after the 2016 election said, I'm going to move to Canada. You actually did it.
Yes.
Right. I mean, so many of us said that, right?
Yes, but we didn't have as much of an impetus. We knew that it's something that we were looking forward to eventually, but at the time before that, our main focus was figuring out where our children are going to go to school, because the LAUSD, that school system is so fraught with so much. I mean, it's like everywhere else in the United States that so much stuff is based on property taxes. And as I try to explain to people that have their individual complaints about all these different ways that people who are not straight white males don't fit into society, it was that we wanted to make sure that our children were getting a good education, that it was available. And sometimes there are considerations that were made at certain schools that were like, okay, it gets out at 1:30. And I'm like, how does school get out at 1:30? Would that have worked then?
Right.
And the assumption, because that was the zone that we're in, was that there would be grandparents or nannies picking up these children. Who couldn't possibly suffer through a full day of school at 5 years old? And I'm like, what? So that was the kind of thing that was on our mind before we entered the process. And now that we're here in Canada, especially in our area, there's a much different mindset of how to live your life. Like, we don't have to spend an hour going 1 mile because of the traffic. We don't have to go to the one park for the 10-mile radius because there's parks everywhere. The schools are actually in one building because it's cold, but also because they have a building for these schools. There are childcare options, even though they're competitive, they exist. Like, the thought that you would need childcare before and after school makes sense to everyone. And there are different options for school. So there's just more options here and a different thought process to life because of how things are set up that were not available in Los Angeles, because it's like everyone feels, well, everything is hard, so everyone has to compete against everyone to get their child in the right charter school. It was so overwhelming to think am I going to get my child into this charter school that has this amenities and they can be with these people who look like them and learn this language, or which child is going to drop out so that my child could get that spot after that child gets someone else's spot. And then whose spot will my child's spot go to? It was a lot. And here it's like, everyone gets education. It's not always great. There's the same nonsense about ableism and racism that is here, but at least it's manageable.
That was going to be one of my other questions about what the racism is like in Canada as opposed to the US.
it's pretty much exactly the same, except we're in Canada. But the thing is that there's a bigger safety net and there's fewer people. So it's, there's a weirdness about the party line for Canada. Is it's not as bad as in the US, as if it doesn't exist, as if there weren't just this year over 1,000 remains of Indigenous children found at residential schools throughout the country. And residential schools ended here in 1996. It's like the mentality of, well, the United States is worse. It's like, well, yes, there's also 10 times more people there. So the racism that everyone experiences is not worse here. There's just, it's a shorter history. It's extensive and people can talk about stuff that is going on, but still be in denial about how it's actually affecting people. The systems aren't the same. Like, it's not just that I can't get information about racial dynamics of our town or these schools. It's that there aren't those type of demographics or even record keeping taking place about anything, regardless of like people, or the information and the research isn't there because Canada doesn't have the budget that United States entities have to even document all of this stuff. It's a lot of like, someone should look into that. Like, right. Okay, great. Now, how are we going to deal with it? But it is nice to not have to worry. Like, we'll deal with the same medical racism here, but it's paid for.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah. So in terms of, you know, I know how the history of how Black women have a hard time getting accessing good healthcare in the US and being treated well by doctors. Do you feel like that's different in Canada?
No, there are those stories. Also, there's only so many Black people here, but there are also the exact same stories happen to Indigenous women throughout Canada that get documented. That's there are the true. Same stories about people of Asian descent having those same things happen to them. It's just that these stories are the same, but we're not all working together because of anti-Blackness and territorialism. So the stories aren't different. There's just fewer news, and Canada News has to cover everything that happens in the United States as well. Whereas the United States does not realize that Canada exists.
Care about Canada. Yes, no. That's right. That's so right. Yeah. Well, and I think that also my experience of Canada is that people are just a little bit nicer in Canada.
Yes, they're more polite. It's this weird politeness that is part of the history of Canada since it has such an influence from Britain. Uh-huh. But through that politeness, there is also a when you stuff down your feelings.
Yes. Suppress.
And so with me in my American upbringing, it's not something that I ever thought about because I was in an American bubble of where everything is America all the time and everything else is different, that I feel entitled to things. And I do not have the same sort of, especially now, marginalized people are being much louder about their marginalization and not just accepting that they should be changing for other people. Mm-hmm. But Canada, I think, is officially 150 years old. I think even though obviously the North American and South American continents have been here forever, but there is a thought that the history is different, particularly I'll be specific with Black people. Compared to United States, the immigration of the Black population is disproportionately more immigrant than native born. Even people who are native born, they feel like their parents came here or their grandparents came here. So there is a sense of being a guest in this country, even though you were born here. Whereas in the United States, most Black people there, their ancestors have been there for hundreds of years before the founding of the United States in some cases. So there's an entitlement that we feel, specifically as Black Americans, that Black Canadians don't have the same whole sense of entitlement as to this country owes me stuff, you better give it to me. And as an American, in general, we feel that wherever we go. So regardless of where we are, there is a sense that, oh, you better treat me properly, not because I'm American, but because that is how you are supposed to do things. And so even though I'm not a loud or brash person, when I'm like, yeah, you, no one should be touching me like that. And you need to act better, and you shouldn't expect people to treat you poorly. You should expect for them to treat you well and be disappointed when they treat you poorly. That sense of moving through the world is not the same regardless of people's racial or ethnic background. So that politeness can be people putting on a happy face when they're actually really mad about something and just keeping it inside, screaming in your heart. And I'm like, scream out loud. Right. Let's get something done.
Yeah, I bet. My husband's from the UK, so I'm familiar with this suppression sort of idea because I'm a direct American. Sometimes I don't feel like I really fit into the culture very much. So yeah. What are some of the things that you've learned since you've been living in Canada about the differences that you haven't already talked about?
I have learned that particularly living through this period of the past 4 years, we live from November of 2016 to July of 2018 in the United States. And so the concept of news outside of the United States was anathema, except for China and Korea possibly figuring out nuclear bombs. And then once we moved from the United States to Canada, I figured I'm in Canada. It's Canada time. Let's talk about Canada all the time. And the thing that my husband and I experienced from people when they learned that we were immigrants from the United States was, let's talk about Trump. And here's my feelings. And I'm like, I didn't ask your feelings. Yes, I thought we were going to be talking about Canada. And they're like, no, Canada news is boring. I have feelings about the United States. And people had deep knowledge of the presidential candidates and why they were being treated unfairly and who should really be doing what with whom. And I was like, wow, I had no idea until I left how much American culture permeates everything in the world, considering it has its own issues and it has a lot going on and a lot going for it. So why don't we focus on that? No, who's doing what here? And I'm like, okay, I liken it to moving from the Capitol in the Hunger Games to District 1. And then seeing how everybody's noses are pressed up against the one-way mirror looking into the United States. Uh-huh. That's been the thing that has disturbed me the most, because during the previous administration, I just wanted other country leaders to step up and do something to run the planet, since our president was not really capable of the depth of thought necessary to be the leader of the world. And they're just like, we'll just wait. And that's what they did. They just waited until the next president would come around. And I was like, you all have so much power that you are yielding. And I understand that it is that the United States has so much resources and so much power and so much control, but we're all living on the planet together. And it was very clear, we don't have time to wait to hope that the next leader will be better. And the images of people just like milling about, like in a holding pattern, were disturbing to me and made me want to to do something, and I don't know exactly what, but connect with people, real people in real organizations, instead of looking to leaders, becoming the leaders and figuring out how to manage in a world without a competent leader.
Very interesting. I found that when I've traveled abroad as well, that people want to talk about whoever the US leader is, and especially Trump, because, you know, he makes people very agitated. So, yes. Let's talk a little bit about what you are doing with your life right now.
What am I doing with my life?
Yes. So you describe yourself as a networking expert for introverts, and you have a business about networking in your pajamas. So I'm curious, because I'm not an introvert, I'm an extrovert. My husband is an outgoing introvert, and I'm a shy extrovert. So what have you found difficult about being a business person and an introvert?
The thing about being an introvert for me is that it's about energy and how I derive my energy. And being an introvert, I derive my energy from quiet time alone, reflecting and being able to recharge on my own. And since the world is designed for extroverts, and among the other things it's designed for, straight white American males who have able bodies and are cisgender, when you have an extrovert designed world, the things that introverts do that are necessary for them to survive, but also are amazing things, are not valued as much. So what I am trying to do through my work, which I shifted from B2C with my online course called How to Network in Your Pajamas, which is available on Thinkific, to B2B, where I have been developing relationships with media corporations and showing HR executives how to increase employee engagement so they decrease employee turnover, particularly in this period of the Great Resignation. I've been emphasizing that introverts have qualities that are valuable, particularly now in this hybrid world where for a extended period, we have been going through a global pandemic where many meetings have been not in person because that was unhealthy. They have been online or on the phone. So those qualities have been not just valuable, but critical and integral to how business is done and how not just business is done, but how people communicate across the globe. Those things are not something to be poo-pooed or eschewed or looked down upon because they aren't extrovert qualities. So I want to encourage any introverts who are listening that your qualities, the ways that you interact with the world, are incredibly valuable, regardless of what the extroverts in your life may say. And extroverts who want to learn from introverts, we have a lot to teach you, but you do need to communicate with us in a way that may be different than you're used to.
For my husband, it's also around the energy issues that he recharges alone after he's been around people for a long period of time. It seems like also some introverts find it more difficult to be around people just in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, my husband is probably more like you that way, but some introverts are also very reserved. And it's interesting because, you know, right before the pandemic, I was seeing a therapist and I was telling her that, I mean, I'm totally extroverted, but I'm shy. And I was talking about how difficult networking is for me because as a business person, it's like, oh my gosh, we have to constantly network, right? And so she said, well, maybe you need to find a different way to network. And then, and then the pandemic happened. It's like, yeah, that's what I needed, a different way to network. And it's really interesting because online networking, or like what you and I did, like we had a discovery call to get to know each other. It's like, that is so much easier for shy people or reserved people. I'm not reserved, but I'm shy. Yeah, it's kind of been a great discovery for me that it's a lot easier to network this way.
Yes, the converse to that is for some extroverts, it has been terrible for them to be in this situation for 2 years because some people need physical people around them. I am someone who does not need that. I love people in general, but some people really need that. If they do not have that physical person in front of them, they cannot conceive of how a relationship will happen. Whereas I have been interacting with people through not just in-person coffee chats, but Zoom coffee chats since 2016, that I have been tutoring people across the world since 2014 and making connections with people that are really strong and have really benefited me over the past few years. The experimentation and figuring out what's the best way to communicate with this person and the many different ways to do that has really benefited me because I have needed to, and it excites me. But for other people who have not been placed in that position and have experienced this, said that, well, I can't interview you through Zoom because I do all my interviews in person. I was like, okay, that really limits who you're going to get. But that's what some people need. And learning both what you need and what other people need is challenging because there's so many of us and so many personalities. But experimentation is something that I suggest for people, even though it can be challenging, to figure out what style works for you and how you make the deepest connections and the most effective connections for your life and for your business.
I agree. I think that's great. So what do you wish people understood about you?
That's something that I've let go of. That's something that I used to think about. I recently turned 40 and I reflected on my 30s and what I was learning about the world and how it was much different than my 20s. So in my 20s, I was trying to apply the lessons that I had learned throughout my education of doing the hard work, meeting the right people, showing people that I was interested and interesting, and then things would work out. And then I did not account for the level of white supremacy and patriarchy that existed despite my extensive education. So I spent my 30s trying to figure out, well, what am I supposed to do with myself if no one wants to hang out with me because I don't come in the right package. And there's a lot of letting go. And I think that the biggest shift came after the 2016 election, because I felt like I kept hearing all these things like the doomsday clock had moved another second or another minute or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was not an existential crisis, but an existential reflection period. I cut my hair because it made more sense to me. I learned more about minimalism, especially due to my move from Los Angeles to Toronto, and living out of two suitcases for four people really put perspective on what was important to you and how much stuff you needed to live your life. So that also applied to people who had been really important to me right as I entered my 30s, who had decided to exit my life for whatever reason and didn't want to tell me. And I said, what am I going to do? And what do I want to put out to the world? And particularly in 2019, after I graduated from Seneca College here in Toronto and was like, I don't know how I'm supposed to find a job. I was looking and no one wanted me. And people acknowledged the immense value of my experience in education and then didn't hire me. So dealing with that, I was like, okay, so there are people who are choosing not to understand who I am because they cannot deal with who I am and the power that I bring as a Black unicorn, which I have a whole speech about. And you don't have to be a Black unicorn. It's someone who knows their worth and has standards and is only appreciated by people who can truly handle the power that they're bringing to the table. So now I don't really want people who have no interest in understanding me to do so. I want to find the people who are excited by me and inspired by me and attracted to me in ways that they want to partner with me if they want to, or just are like cheering me on, because those are the people who I believe are going to help make this world a better and more equitable place. And the people who choose not to understand me for whatever reason, and there are lots of people of various colors and genders who choose not to understand me, maybe they'll understand me later, or maybe they won't. But I want to focus on the things and the people and the experiences and places that bring me joy.
That's wonderful. Have you read anything or watched something recently that has inspired you?
I would have to think about what recently inspired me because I've been watching Grey's Anatomy on a loop, and that's quite a show.
That's interesting because I had never watched Grey's Anatomy until the pandemic, and I binged on it earlier this year. That's so funny.
There are so many episodes.
It took me a while.
if Murder, She were on Netflix in Canada, I would never have revisited Grey's Anatomy. There's so many episodes, I'm like, all right, I'll keep going. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I would want listeners to be inspired by, as I have, is a book called Meeting Your Half Orange by Amy Spencer. It is a book about finding your partner, your media naranja, your half orange, someone who doesn't complete you, but makes you feel like together you are bigger than who you were separately. And it's a book that I got after a terrible rejection during the last semester of business school back in 2010. I read the book, followed the activities in it, including making a dream board, including what I wanted in a partner. And then I found my future husband. So I continued making dream boards, and they have worked, including the one that I made specifically for us moving to Toronto. And now we live in one of the areas that was on the board that I had not heard of before and didn't really pay attention to. So that book really changed my life. And I turn to it in times when I feel like I don't know what I'm doing. And is anything I'm doing really what I should be doing? And then remembering that it's not enough to just say, oh, I want this. You have to tell people about it and live it and experience it and believe in it and stop doubting. But it has also encouraged me to think of things as not what is impossible, but what is improbable and what's implausible, and change that into how can I make the improbable a probability?
Yeah, that's great. I'd love to have pictures of your dream boards when we publicize this, if you're willing to share them.
Oh, sure. I have a blog. I have multiple blogs, but this one is called I Have a Dream Board. Oh. And there are posts there that I can share with you.
That would be great. Yeah, that's really interesting. I have the same beliefs about the relationship thing. I hadn't read the book, but many years ago, when I was in very, very many years ago, because I'm 57, when I was in college, I wrote a list of what I was looking for in a man. And then I put it aside, and then I met my husband, and it's like, and then I found the list again. It's like, oh my God, he has every single characteristic that I wrote down. It was so weird.
I believe
in that.
Yes. The weird thing is that sometimes you think you're going to put all these things down and then you're going to find that person. But what actually happens is, yes, you'll find that person, but because you want that and you express that to that person, the person works with you to achieve those goals with you.
Yeah. I would love to do a dream board for my business though. So I'm interested in learning more about your approach. That's great. So my final question that I always ask, is there a story of grit and resilience or finding someone's fertile ground that has been an inspiration for you in your life?
So there's a woman who worked at NBC, I think right as I was interning, and then she left right as I started working there. And she was focused on diversity and inclusion. Her name is Paula Madison. She and her family's business owned the LA Sparks at a point. She was also an NBC Universal executive. She eventually left, focused on her family's business, which owned the LA Sparks at the time. And then after I left NBC, she was speaking at an EY event for Black History Month. She was telling her story, and she talked about how working up the ranks at NBC, she was performing excellently above and beyond expectations for anyone at that level at that point. And she kept being denied the position that she rightly deserved to run this whole division. Mm-hmm. Then she moved on to another position at NBC, and she was talking about at the time her desire to learn more about her family's history, because her family came from Jamaica and her grandfather was a Chinese immigrant to Jamaica. And at the time that she was making this speech, back in the early 2010s, she was doing history. She was doing research to write a book about this journey. And then she wrote the book. And then she also did a documentary. And she presented that documentary here a couple of years ago with York University, because her family, her extended family, also lives in the Toronto area. And she showed the documentary to us. And they are part of the Hakka Chinese. And so they are part of a Chinese diaspora throughout the world. There's a significant Chinese population in Jamaica. There's also a Chinese population here of Chinese Jamaicans. And so I actually got to meet her and tell her that I saw her speak. And the thing that I really resonated with her speaking, not only creating this book and this and learning more about her family and finding her roots from 1,000 years ago and presenting this documentary, was that so much of Black American experience is told to be Black excellence and do your best and be undeniable. And you have to, there's all this respectability politics about it. And at the time that she was speaking, no one was telling me about how you can be your best and be better than everybody else, and you can still be denied what you deserve. And it really resonated with me because she was one of the only people, particularly Black executives at that time, who were talking about how excellence isn't enough. And it's not about being your best or dressing right or speaking right or wearing the right things. Some people are just going to deny you, and that sucks. And then you go on and do something else instead of trying to pretend like if you just play the game correctly, then you'll win. You're not going to win because those people just aren't going to appreciate you. So it was inspiring to me to hear her say that, well, paraphrasing what she said, but also that somehow, like, there's no way I would have thought, oh yeah, she's going to come and be a few miles away from me so I can watch her documentary that she finally made like 6 years later in a completely different country where she has family from Jamaica. Like, that was insane to me. And sometimes I like to see those as signs of, you need to focus on the right people, not the people who are necessarily the loudest, because most people probably don't know who she is, but she has made enough of a fortune with her family so that they can create this for themselves and for their other family members to learn more about who they are and possibly inspire other people to see, as she said in the documentary, that our history as Black Americans doesn't begin and end with slavery. There's more to our history than that. It's not 500 years old. It's thousands of years old.
Thank you so much. That's all that I have. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
If anyone wants to follow what I'm doing, I'm on Instagram and I'm on LinkedIn. Those are the two best places. If you type in my name, the first part of my first name, M-A-H-L-E-N-A, Malena, in Google, you'll find everything about me. And I encourage other people to, especially the introverts out there, to find their joy.
Yes. Well, this has been a pleasure, Malena, getting to know you better. And I look forward to our future conversations.
Yay.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I enjoyed hearing Malena's take on life in Canada versus the United States. I'm going to drop her dream board post in the show notes, in addition to a link to her website. You can see photos and learn more about Malena at www.fertilegroundcommunications.com. Look for the Fighting Fertile Ground podcast tab. Listeners, I hope you're holding up during this never-ending pandemic. Did this episode inspire you? I'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions for Malena or me, or have an idea for a guest or topic I should cover, drop me a line at marie@fertilegroundcommunications.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening to the Fighting Fertile Ground podcast. If you liked today's episode, please subscribe and leave a review.